Today, a journey to Antarctica. In January, The Guardian's global environment editor, Jonathan Watts, had an experience he will never forget. He was in Antarctica, on a tiny boat with a group of research scientists.
We were sitting on a rib. It's a kind of motor dinghy that is used to take people out from the bigger ships. We cut the engine and stopped talking so that we could hear nature much more clearly. We were surrounded by snow-capped peaks and blue glaciers. The water was extraordinarily still and cold and had so many fragments of ice in it. It looked as if the sky had collapsed like a mirror into shards that were bobbling around on the surface. It was, I think, the most beautiful place I've seen in my life. So we're bobbing around on the boat, and then Tim Lewis, who's one of the scientists on board, he drops a hydrophone on a cable down into the depths.
So that's about 4 metres there.
The hydrophone is basically just a microphone on a very long piece of cable.
Just turn it on.
So now recording.
You can see we've got something on the sound levels, and I'm just going to have a listen to see what we can...
And he put on the headphones, and he looked... so baffled. When it was my turn to listen, I thought I had an idea of what the sound might be. But once I put on the headphones, it was so unlike what I was expecting. It sounded to me as if it was a drip. Or lots of drips, but in fact, it was the fizz or the popping of lots of bubbles that had been stored in the ice for hundreds or possibly thousands of years as the ice melted and these bubbles were released. It was a kind of upside down sound. I just found it incredible, also slightly horrifying, knowing that what I was listening to was the sound of an iceberg melting. And that, of course, is one of the sounds of the climate crisis.
One of the reasons, perhaps, that humanity has repeatedly failed to respond to the climate emergency is that some elements of it happen gradually, quietly, almost imperceptibly. Whilst every now and then, some of the consequences of global heating, like recent bushfires in Australia, appear before us in a dramatic way. Others, like the melting of an iceberg, happen relatively slowly and in the background. It's not something that most of us can see for ourselves. But if you go to Antarctica, you can see it. And as Jonathan found out, you can hear it too. If there's one place on Earth where the effects of climate change are more tangible than anywhere else on Earth, it's here. The physical environment of Antarctica is changing on a daily basis. That's why scientists see this continent as a place uniquely qualified to measure the ways in which human activity is hurting the planet. And a place where perhaps they can find solutions too. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus... a journey to Antarctica, measuring the scale of the climate crisis.
It's often said that Antarctica is kind of a continent-sized laboratory.
This is Will McCallum. He's head of oceans at Greenpeace UK, and he's on a mission.
It's so untouched relative to the rest of the world. It's so pristine compared to so much of the rest of the world because there has never been a permanent human habitation. So that really makes it perfect for these kinds of experiments that are trying to understand what our world used to be like, our natural systems that keep life on Earth going.
Along with a team of nearly 70 scientists, engineers and activists, Will is travelling across Antarctica, measuring the effects of human activity on the region. He and his team are just some of the hundreds of researchers here.
Scientists are working on many different projects. Some of them are diving to explore the seabed. Others are taking measurements every day to see what the weather is doing so that we can add that into big global data sets that would help us understand climate change better. Some of them are looking at soil erosion and looking at bacteria in lichen. You know, there's all kinds of different experiments going on.
The expedition is 10 months long, and Jonathan Watts is joining for the final leg.
We need the first leg. Thank you very much.
The first place we visited was King George Island. It's a centre of scientific research. There are the research bases of 10 countries and about 500 semi-permanent residents. And they live together in a kind of utopian setup where science and peace take priority over everything else. As far as hubs of activity go in the Antarctic, this is the busiest place.
Somewhere this remote, 600 miles away from Cape Horn, the most southern tip of South America, many of the world's problems can feel very far away. Antarctica is the only continent not to have a single case of coronavirus. But it is vulnerable to the other great global crisis, the climate emergency.
On the 24th of December, the Antarctic probably suffered its worst one-day ice melt since records began. A couple of weeks after I was there, Antarctica registered two records. First, on the mainland of 18.3 degrees Celsius, and then a few days later, a continental record of more than 20 degrees Celsius. On that day, on that island, that part of the Arctic was hotter than Cape Town. One scientist told me that normally they arrive at the start of summer, which in the Antarctic is around about October. And every year for decades, they've been making a mark on the wall of their research base at the level where the snow was when they arrived, because they usually have to dig out their bases. But he told me that last October, they didn't make a mark because there was already no snow. They didn't have to do any digging.
The physical landscape in Antarctica is also showing up how interconnected the different elements of the climate crisis are. In January, monitoring equipment at one of the research bases on King George Island detected black carbon in the air, which came from the Australian bushfires more than 6,000 miles away. This is worrying enough on its own terms, a grim reminder of what happened in Australia. But scientists also worry about how it might compound the existing problems here.
What they found were minuscule amounts of black carbon, but because this black carbon changes the colour of the ice, even fractionally, it could accelerate the melting because black surfaces reflect less heat than white surfaces. It was yet another sign that Antarctica is not protected by its isolation anymore.
Jonathan's journey took him to places where few people have ever set foot. Desolate, storm-battered landscapes like the island of Io.
We were told we were the first people ever to camp on this island, and you could see why when you're there. It's cold, it's wet, it's grey, and there is a cacophony from all the hundreds of thousands of penguins around you. One of the world's biggest penguin colonies. It was just incredible to hear them.
While many of the physical signs of climate change that John saw in Antarctica are crystal clear at first glance, others only reveal themselves when you look closely, like the changing wildlife populations across the continent.
We were there with a group of US scientists who were also on the Greenpeace ships, and they were counting penguins to see the health of populations. And their particular focus was two types of penguins. One, the chinstrap. Which is an Antarctic specialist. And the other, the Gen 2. Which is a more generalist bird that can eat lots of different things and seems to thrive in warmer climates. A trend that has been observed across the Antarctic is that the chin straps are declining dramatically by 40 or 50% over the past 10, 20, 30 years, and the Gen 2 are moving in. The theory is that this is happening due to climate change. The next places we visited on the journey were Hannah Point and Discovery Bay, and it was at the latter that we could see one of the main reasons why chinstrap penguin numbers are going down so fast. Chinstrap penguins depend on krill, and krill seem to be losing ground to another tiny life form. It's a tiny little tube of transparent jelly with a pink dot for a belly that you can see from the top of the ship because of these little strips of red dots. And this creature is called a salp. And what scientists are finding that is that as water's warm, these tiny little zooplankton, they are thriving at the expense of krill. And that means that the creatures who depend on krill, such as chinstraps, they're finding it much harder because we don't know if they can eat salps. As a result of climate change, there are fewer chinstraps and more Gen 2. There's also less krill and more salps. Everything is shifting. It's a kind of a canary in the coal mine, revealing something maybe broken in the ecosystem of the Antarctic.
A decline in krill populations is not just bad for chinstrap penguins. It's also bad news for the climate. Krill play a major role in helping the ocean absorb carbon dioxide, and so begins a feedback loop, a vicious cycle. As the ice melts, the krill reproduce at a lower rate. With fewer krill, less CO2 is absorbed, and as less CO2 is absorbed, more ice melts. These feedback loops exist throughout the phenomenon of climate change. The existence of a problem has consequences that cause the problem itself to accelerate.
It's 9 a.m. in the morning. There's a very light snow, but the conditions are incredible.
It was at Trinity Island that Jonathan first encountered a tourist cruise ship.
They're enormous. I mean, there's thousands of tons of steel. They've got 10, 15 decks at least. They look like mini worlds.
Good morning, everyone. If you look at the port side of the ship through your balcony, you may see a humpback whale. Do not miss it.
And tonight, I'm going to start with the deep-fried crispy calamari. For my soup, I'll go with the maple-roasted pumpkin and ginger. And then for the main course, the grilled salmon. And I'll finish it all off with the baked New York-style cheesecake. Hence the reason we're gaining the polar pounds. As you can see, there wasn't a lot of activity today, but a lot of eating.
After dinner, most people filter up to the bar where Randy plays.
This summer, a record 80,000 tourists were expected in Antarctica, an almost threefold increase from 2015. Before the coronavirus pandemic, shipbuilders had been seeing strong demand for polar cruise liners. Luxury cruise operators have tried to outdo one another with heated deck igloos, underwater lounges and extendable viewing platforms.
The Discovery experience starts with our own fleet of custom-built Zodiacs boarded on either side of the ship via our lowering platform. Guests can also choose to explore the underwater world aboard the ship's own 7-seat submarine, where you can witness penguins, whales and seals in their natural habitat.
Tourists pay up to $20,000 to experience what brochures describe as the Earth's last great wilderness frontier.
And Antarctica is great for couples. It offers that perfect mix of sort of action, and if you want to get out and do some hiking and walking, there's great zodiac excursions and you can get out and view the wildlife. So it's a really accessible destination. You can be as active as you like. It also offers a lot in terms of history that many people are really interested in. You can follow in the footsteps of Shackleton.
There was one point on the trip where we were going to do some scientific research and a cruise ship was already there and they told us to wait. And I remember one of the crew of the Arctic Sunrise coming in somewhat indignant to say, well, the tourists have taken precedence over the science because the tourists on board have paid to be alone in the Antarctic. It's trying to create this illusion of being on an expedition at the end of the world. I was told that the ship's captains make sure that their passengers don't see other ships as much as possible. So sometimes they'll wait in a little cove while another ship passes by just to keep this impression going of being a solitary vessel in the middle of nowhere.
When you are going to a destination like Antarctica, it's incredibly remote. Things don't always go to plan, and so it's really important that you have booked this trip through people that have the experience and that you can trust and rely on.
Another part of the pitch is that even this last great wilderness will not look like this much longer. The idea being, come and see these glaciers and icebergs before they've all melted. This is your last chance. And so begins another feedback loop. Just like the case of the melting sea ice and the krill. The more the Antarctic is threatened by the climate crisis, the more tourists want to visit before it melts away. That means more crews and air miles to the end of the Earth, more carbon dioxide and more global heating.
Anybody who's going on one of these last chance to see tours is having to help destroy the environment. In a sense, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. You're making it the last chance to see. You know, the irony was brought home to me one night when our ship was anchored in this incredibly beautiful scene and I'd never seen the water so still and I was sort of drinking it all in and then I could hear a disco on a ship that was anchored nearby playing Casey and the Sunshine Band. That's the way, I like it, And I went to bed with that in my mind thinking, oh God, is this the modern day anthem of the Antarctic?
Disco music from cruise ships isn't the only noise pollution here. International shipping traffic has also increased in Antarctica, and it's extremely loud. The effect this is having on wildlife is something being investigated by some of the scientists on the Greenpeace expedition. One of them is the marine mammal scientist, Dr. Kirsten Thompson.
For certain species, for most species, all species of cetaceans are heavily reliant on vocalising, therefore communicating with each other, or for catching their prey, and they use sound in their daily lives all the time, a bit like we do. And so if they're having to communicate in an incredibly noisy place, that noise can actually mask their communications and they just can't hear each other. There are certain species that are particularly sensitive to, say, military exercises or something like that. So beaked whales are one of those sort of species groups. They're very deep divers. And if they're startled by some of these loud noises that we make, then they can rise to the surface way too quickly and end up with gas embolism and basically end up with the bends. And they can sometimes be found stranded because of that.
Coming up, the worst impact of the climate crisis might be visible in the Antarctic. but so are signs of possible solutions. The situation in Antarctica seems increasingly grim. Some scientists believe the melting of West Antarctica is so far beyond natural fluctuations that it has become irreversible, and they fear a collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet. It might feel hopeless, but this continent is not just an example of the damage humans can do to the planet. It's also an example of how we can learn from or even reverse our mistakes by working together. Take the horrifying discovery of the 1980s, that chemicals had thinned the ozone layer and opened up a vast hole in the stratosphere above the Antarctic. Amazingly, international efforts to reduce ozone-depleting chemicals have reversed the trend. Then there's the story of Wales.
The story of Wales was absolutely horrendous for almost all of the 20th century.
His Royal Highness had come to see for himself what this ice-bound region inhabited by seals and penguins was like. Whaling is the chief industry in these parts, and this is how he was transferred to the whale-catching vessel. The Duke, who'd grown a trim beard, went to inspect the ship and talk to her company about their jobs.
Whaling ships used to go out to the far regions of the Earth, especially the Antarctic, to hunt down whales right up until the middle of the century.
The hunters used the whale blubber for oils, candles, and cosmetics. Several species of whale, including the blue, right, and say. Were hunted close to extinction. Others, such as the humpback, suffered an estimated 90% decline. But then, in the latter half of the century, something changed.
From then onwards, you had a series of actions, international collaboration to try to save the whale, and there are moratoriums on hunting that have been respected by almost all the countries in the world, with one or two exceptions like Japan and Iceland and Norway, and a lot more effort to protect their habitats. The conservation efforts, the international regulations, the collaboration between countries has had an effect, and whale numbers in the past 10, 20, 30 years have bounced right back. And in some cases, like the humpback and the minke, are almost thought to be back at the levels they were before hunting started.
Of all the moments during John's trip, not many were hopeful, but one stands out as an exception.
We were out on the boat again. Then, just as the sun was breaking out from some clouds, there was the sight of this humpback and came straight towards us. And I was filled with wonder, and it disappeared under the waters, and we wondered where it would come up. And then it came up right next to the boat, circled to one side, and then turned over, yawned, a huge, huge mouth suddenly appeared right before us. It was Jonavision. You could see the bristles that it uses to process the food. You could see its huge tongue. It was almost within reach, that close. Then it sort of turned back and went back under the water. And there were about five of us on board, and we all looked at each other.
It's just extraordinary. I mean, how often do you get whales coming this close?
It's quite rare to have them so comfortable that they come within meters while still feeding. It's one of those moments you sort of sit back and think, what have I done right to get to this scenario where I'm sat meters away from a very happy humpback feeding.
Just an extraordinary natural high, the best kind of natural high you can have. A very special moment.
I'm still buzzing. We're so excited, wasn't it, Kirsten? We're all grinning.
I don't know what to say.
It was total silence.
As part of his job as Global Environment Editor, Jonathan Watts has reported from many remarkable places. But he's never experienced anything quite like the hope and despair of the Antarctic.
I feel it was a place where I truly understood what the world can be, what nature can be, and at the same time, how fragile and threatened that is. I've never seen beauty as beautiful. I've never seen a threat as menacing. In one sense, it is the last great protected place on Earth. And so it could be a rallying point for nature. It could be something that humanity could build on, a really positive example of what humanity could do, or it could be the last domino to fall. So for both of those two perspectives, this was a journey that I think couldn't fail to strengthen my determination to report on it as a journalist and also as a human being to feel like I need to do something to reverse some of these damaging processes that are affecting even the most remote region on Earth.
That was Jonathan Watts, The Guardian's Global Environment Editor, who has written a beautiful article about his journey that's illustrated with wonderful photographs. I do urge you to take a look at theguardian.com. The piece is called The Sound of Icebergs Melting, My Journey into the Antarctic. That's it for today. My thanks to Jonathan Watts. This episode was produced by Chika Ayres and Josh Kelly. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.